Folks, this is Screen Watching. Each week we talk about the screen, we talk about the movies, we talk about the TV shows. This week we are just talking about movies, and I'm not sure why, because I think we can all agree that the best thing on TV this year was The Curse, and yet here we are trying to fashion together some sort of a list, top 10 lists, if you will, of our best movies of 2023.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher, mother,
secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Are we calling this our... Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Screen Watching Best of Films 2023 edition. Are we calling this our best of? Can we be that presumptuous that we know what the best are? Or are these our favourite films?
So... last year, I was going through this as a bit of a process because, like, I've written things like, oh, my best or my favorite or whatever. And then I thought, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to take complete ownership over it. So for the last couple of years, when I publish this to my daily newsletter, I call it the definitive list of the films and TV shows of whatever.
Yes.
So there's no argument.
I did see your best movies.
It's definitive. There's no argument.
I know. I did see you publish your newsletter without giving away when we record this, but you did have your definitive best of TV through the week, which I thought, oh, that's so Dan Barrett.
Yeah. Actually, it was last week, just so people can accurately date when we recorded this podcast.
Exactly right. So check it out. Go on your website and check it out.
Yeah, look, so one of the difficulties as we put this list together, every podcast is somebody's first podcast, so just putting some stuff down on the table. Simon's the film guy. He sees a lot of the movies through the year. I'm the TV guy, and then we come together in this podcast, and somehow we make it work. But as a result of that, Simon sees so many more movies than I do every year, so just keep that in a bit of perspective as well. It doesn't mean his choices are better. In fact, I think we'll all agree at the end of this that they're not, but he has seen a bunch of movies. The other thing as well is that because of the nature of movies and awards, award systems and shows and whatnot, generally you find that there's always a glut of the best movies of the year, tend to get dropped out right over this Christmas period. What it does mean is that often the best movie of the year will be something that comes out on Boxing Day. I suspect that the best movie of this year is Poor Things. I have not seen Poor Things. There have been some screenings around the place and I just could not get to any of them. And as a result,
choice.
I haven't seen it. Yeah. But I mean, I suspect that's true, but it doesn't make my list because I haven't had the chance to see it. So I've tried to see as much as I can ahead of time, but I've got some things outstanding. As we record this, I haven't seen Poor Things. I haven't seen Society of the Snow, okay, which I hear is very good. So that's kind
Still
of interesting.
Keen to see that. Very excited to see that. We haven't seen Aquaman 2, and I know you're a big Aquaman fan. That could have made it.
You know what?
There.
That original Aquaman movie was probably the worst thing I saw that year, and I really just effing hated it. But the two guys that I saw it with, whose opinion I usually hold with a reasonable level of respect, like, they loved it. I don't understand
idiots.
It.
They're idiots.
The first one was hot
people.
Garbage.
Can I ask you a quick question before we go? I'm sure it will. I am very fortunate to have a Letterboxd account. Those who know and love Letterboxd, it can become a
fortunate
a compelling.
As though everybody can't just sign up.
Well, you can just sign up. I've taken advantage of all the bells and whistles on the Letterboxd site. Have a guess how many movies I've seen to date this year. Now, since I started my Letterboxd account, I've watched 5,091 films. I know for a fact that the biggest year I ever had, which was, a few years ago now, 2017, 2018, when I literally had nothing going on, I saw 712 movies. That's still my record. I'm nowhere near that this year. But how many movies do you think I've watched this year?
Like, that's two movies a day. Like, that's not tremendously impossible. It's sad, but
it's a little sad.
Okay, so for context, me, a normal human being, I saw 75 movies this year. So
oh
how many
my
have
God.
You? What have you seen?
Well, take that 75 and add exactly 400 to it. I saw 475 movies this year. Now, bear in mind, I'm a film festival programmer, so I also, I mean, I'm watching a whole lot of movies for my festival. So that certainly adds to it. And I'm seeing or trying to see every new release for this podcast and the review segments I do. So it's kind of a one in all in with me. So 475 movies. Oh, my God, what a life I lead.
So just for, because people need to balance things out and really understand sort of where a person's coming from, 475 movies in 2023, how many episodes of The Bear have you seen during this time?
I started to press play on the other one, then I had to go to the bathroom and I forgot that I'd left it on pause. So I've seen maybe about 10 minutes.
Okay. That's just a data point for everyone to keep in mind. Simon Foster, I don't think we should just dilly-dally too much here. I think we need right in.
Yeah,
that's yeah, what I do. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to do this. 10 through 1, we're going to go 1-1. When we come up to a double up, I guess we'll just treat it as, you know, ad hoc. We'll see how we go.
Push through it and see how we go. There's a couple of, there's some very big omissions from my one. Looking, when I put my 10 together, and I won't say what they are now because they may come up in your ones, but there's some, certainly some fine things in my next best 10, as I like to call it. Kick us off, Dan. What's your 10th best film, 10th most definitive film of 2023? I didn't even know that's a phrase.
Well, but before I offer my 10th, can I just sort of say this, which is that the last, I don't know, we'll say maybe 5 years of cinema, I found this to be a fairly lackluster experience. But this year, it just kind of feels as though even some of the films that weren't really my favorites and the ones I really just didn't care for that much just seemed far and away better than things I've just seen in recent years. It just kind of felt like consistently I was just having really good experiences going to the movies.
Wow, that's very upbeat of you. Usually when we talk cinema, you're the naysayer, you're the death bell ringer. So that's a very upbeat start for you. So I'm glad you said that. Good on you, mate.
Appreciate. I felt that way about TV as well this year. Like, it's just been a strong year, I think, for screen culture.
And but I think that's been reflected in our podcast. So,
yeah. Number 10 on the list, I've got the movie Air.
1984 has been a tough year. Our sales are down, our growth is down.
Sonny, I brought you in here to grow the basketball business.
People don't know what the hell a Nike is.
What's a Converse?
NBA All-Star shoe.
There's nothing cool about Nike.
You would have to have a pretty compelling pitch.
I can tell them the one thing the other companies can't compete with. Our basketball division is terrible.
So this, people will remember, is the Matt Damon, Ben Affleck directed and written movie. It's a fairly small film, just looking at the signing of Michael Jordan by Nike back in the mid to late 80s for the shoe that would eventually become the Air Jordan. Fairly small movie, but there was just something that was so comforting and
hugely entertaining.
The film kind of felt like it was deliberately a throwback to a type of movie which you just don't really see made that often. It was very jovial. It was very dude heavy, which,
what a dude.
If you think about, if you think about the sort of cultural reckoning, if we want to phrase it that way, from the last couple of years, where filmmakers and funding bodies, whether that's corporate or government sort of orange-head funding bodies, they're all very much trying to sort of reach sort of gender parity and provide sort of greater sort of access and equality and whatnot. But it's kind of felt like this was going out of its way just to be such a throwback to the kind of movies that used to dominate movie screens in the 80s and 90s. And it's just very just dude heavy. And there was something that was comforting about that. And maybe that's a bad thing. In fact, it probably almost certainly is. But at the same time, part of me just reacted very fondly to it.
No dramas from me there. I really love the film. My 10th film of this year is maybe the opposite to where, because it's not a dude-heavy film at all. It's called Bottoms.
Could the ugly, untalented gays please report to the principal's office?
Guess that's you guys.
Tonight is our night. We're getting the cooch.
I'm going to talk to Brittany.
You could say hi to Isabel.
What would I say?
Hey, girl. How's your boyfriend?
How's his penis?
This is the comedy that Rachel Sennett and director and writer Emma Seligman followed up their Shiver Baby with from a few years back. Shiver Baby sort of set the mood for this. It's the little baby sister to Bottoms. It was a cringy character-based comedy with a really tart mouth and a big heart, and this is more of the same. Plus, this has got the added sheen of a studio teen movie, but it's no less brimming with that sort of indie kind of FU joie de vivre, I guess you could say. Plus, it's got It Girl, Ayo Edebiri in there as well from the aforementioned Bear, and she really seals the deal. I loved Bottoms, A, because it was very, very funny, and B, because it sort of took the teen comedy to the next level. We all thought it was going to be another Superbad, and it was that in terms of the laughs, but it also had this really progressive but not preachy kind of take on the teen comedy. So Bottoms is my number 10.
Yeah, I rather liked Bottoms, but I don't know. This is maybe just that danger of seeing things after it was so overhyped. The film just didn't really live up to me. It's certainly better than most films of the genre, but I don't know. I just expect just a little bit more. I expect to find it a little bit funnier. And there was something, and sorry, this is going to be a minor spoiler for the end, but there's a whole bunch of people that die at the end of the movie, and it's kind of brushed off. And that's fine. Like, I think that's a funny conceit generally, but it was just so far off the comedic sensibility of the rest of what was permissible within a film. So every film sets up.
No, I don't think that. I thought it really had that Heather's edge to it, and Heather's ended with a similar sort of insane moment
but
of
Heather's,
mass destruction and carnage.
Heather's earned that though, because the entire film is playing around the concepts of life and death and suicide and who wants to live, who wants to die. This was just blatantly an entirely different world structural approach. It's like, well, you know, they just murdered a whole bunch of people, but you know, there's gonna be no repercussions for that, and that just kind of took it to a step that was just a little bit far outside of the bounds of what that established in that movie. Number 9 on my list, Simon, is a small indie film which came with a whole bunch of expectation, much like Bottoms. But unlike Bottoms, to me, it lived up to and met the expectation. It's called Past Lives.
Who do you think they are to each other?
I don't know.
Yeah, this is a hard one.
I think the white guy and the Asian girl are a couple, and the Asian guy is her brother.
Or the Asian girl and the Asian guy are a couple, and the white guy is their American friend.
They're not even talking to the white guy.
Maybe they're tourists, and the white guy is their tour guide.
Drinking at 4 a.m.?
Yeah, you're right, that makes no sense.
So, Simon, Past Lives, I presume you've seen this.
Oh, certainly seen it. Very much so, sir. Yes.
Yeah. Did you feel it lived up to expectation is probably the big question.
I don't want to say too much. Let's just say that it may feature at some point in this podcast a little bit later on. So I don't want to say
you
too
much. You can say it made your list. Like, that's fine.
Okay,
well, let's just discuss the movie now. And then when we get to it on the list, we'll add any sort of further thoughts. Look, so obviously it met expectation for you. This was a film where... Look, I'm not a huge fan of the lead actress in it, Greta Lee. This is largely, and we did talk about this, as I recall now, largely it comes from her being a regular presence on the TV show The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus. And I think that show is fairly terrible, and she is especially terrible on that program. So it may be sort of residual energy coming from that, which kind of puts me off on this. But this film, which was about a woman who, as a young girl, had left South Korea, moved to New York with her family, and then got reacquainted with a, not even quite a love interest, but certainly a young boy that she'd spent some time with. And it was like a furtive sort of first love that never really quite sort of reached that point. Reconnects with him, and he becomes a bit of a presence in her life, to the point where eventually he ends up coming to New York, and they spend two days together in New York. And you expect it to be a little bit like a Before Sunrise kind of a thing, being a very sort of talky movie, but it's not that at all. Instead, what I really found refreshing about this is that it played it exactly how that kind of plays out in real life, which is she's already got a husband at that point. And so he's in an awkward position. She is like emotionally sort of torn slightly, but also she's moved on. But it's that idea of what could our lives have been? What is it that we sort of missed out on because our lives went in these opposite directions?
Yeah. It's a film that sort of feels like a romance, but it's almost like an anti-romance in that fate has determined that these two aren't going to be together, but they are always going to be sort of connected in some way or another. And the twist in the film is that it's sort of based in some kind of mythical sort of belief that our souls go through many different incarnations and are always crossing paths until we get that right moment when we can be together. And that's what this is a film is about. I'll have a bit of a rave about it later, but I thought this was a lovely film.
Yeah. So the two things that I really liked about it is that one, they never let them sort of get together at the end. And I really liked the role, and I don't know the name of the actor that plays her husband in it. I really like how quiet that is. Like that guy is just kind of in the background of those scenes or sitting right next to them as what could be the, No, the husband, not the...
Yeah, he's acting, the actor's name is T-O-U.
No, that's the South Korean guy, the American guy.
John Magaro. Sorry, yeah, John Magaro, yeah.
Yes. Okay. I don't know how often I have to say husband. But anyway, I like that he's just kind of sitting there and he's kind of letting it sort of wash over him and he doesn't speak the language, so there's a lot of the conversation that he's just kind of sitting there clearly concerned about. But at no point is he sort of the guy starts shouting or starts crying for no reason.
No, there's no histrionics in this film. It's not a
Yeah, exactly.
There's no histrionics in this film. It's not a place for big acting. It's about small moments and beautifully staged small moments.
Absolutely. And the other thing I quite like is that they never actually let the relationship between either of them reach a point where it's an actual relationship. So they're torn away from each other as young kids before anything blossoms. And again, they're reunited at a stage where nothing really can happen. And her particularly isn't really allowing anything to happen. Okay. And it's just, it's that distance, it's that restraint that I really liked.
You can feel the longing. Yeah. Good call. I'll come back on that a little bit later with a little bit more to add, but it's a great, great film. My number nine is an animated film. Now, there were some great animated films this year. I know that Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse got a whole lot of the critical love, but my little film this year is called Nimona.
Once upon a time in a fairy tale kingdom. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Oh, what a peculiar bird you are. And now go make me a dress. Make your own dress.
This premiered on Netflix in the middle of the year. This is all set in a fantasy world. I mean, to me, this was great because it's all set in this fantasy world where the latest Disney princess is not the sort of bog standard heteronormative stereotype, but instead she's an androgynous punk rock shapeshifter with a taste for real wicked misadventure. The design work and the take that this puts on the fairy tales of yore is really energizing and really original. I thought it was an absolute line in the sand moment for animation, one of cinema's oldest disciplines. And I, with Chloe Grace Moretz providing the voice of Nimona, I thought she was the animated princess sort of to really get behind this year. I love Nimona. I don't know if you ever saw Nimona.
Never saw it. I really, I was eager to see her, and then for some reason I completely forgot it existed.
Yeah, definitely worth checking it out. And I love, don't get me wrong, I love Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse too. So it was a good year for animated films, but Nimona was just a bit out there in front.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting you said that, considering there were a bunch of animated films that I know you didn't bother to go and see, including my number eight on the list here, Suzume.
Yeah, no, didn't see that.
Hey, look, Simon, let's play a clip.
まさか。まさか。
Okay, so Simon, Suzume, the reason I wanted to go along and see this movie was that it's the latest film from Makoto Shinkai. He's the gentleman responsible for Your Name and Weathering With You. These are two anime films that I got along to just purely out of reputation that apparently both were quite good. Well, at least that was the case with Your Name. I went and saw Weathering With You because I had such a strong response to Your Name. And I had not quite an equal response to Weathering With You, but still a strong response. Suzume, I think, is probably on equal par with Weathering With You. It is a story which, much like the rest of his movies, are metaphors for a lot of the tragedy that's taken place within Japan in the last couple of years in terms of natural disasters. This one is very much related to the nuclear meltdown from, what was it, 2013? Thereabouts. Yeah. Again, high fantasy. This is something where, I don't even know really how to describe this because he blends comedic high concept fantasy so well with some really grounded emotional storytelling, which comes very much from the heart. This is emotions on the sleeve anime in a really big, impactful way. My wife came along to it. She didn't really know what to expect. And she had a fairly strong response to it as well. I just think, you know, good quality anime.
Nice. Well, should check it out. My number eight is a film that really slipped under a lot of people's radar. It's called Reality.
The Russians attacked our democracy.
They didn't attack.
Reality. Were you surprised to see us today?
It stars Sidney Sweeney as the intelligence specialist who blew the whistle on Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. For me, this was the work that took Sidney Sweeney from being the next big thing to the big thing. It's directed by Tina Satter. She gives this ultra-realistic portrayal. Sidney Sweeney gives this ultra-realistic portrayal of Reality Winner's takedown. The script is taken from a lot of the redacted material that came from the actual seizing of Reality in her own home and the questioning that went back and forth between her and the officials played by Josh Hamilton and Marchant Davis. I imagine this film back in the 70s or 80s with a young Shelley Duvall or Sissy Spacek in the same part. They have this sort of, on the outside, they have this kind of brittle fragility that you think is going to crack under this pressuring, but you also get the sense that it's really grounded in this sort of bedrock of integrity, the way the way the actress takes control of the character conveys the convictions of the characters. And I thought it was one of the great performances of the year. Then I saw her in Anyone But You, which was in hit cinemas on Boxing Day. And she's terrible and everyone's terrible in it. And all I kept thinking was how great she was in Reality. And it's my number eight title.
Well, you just ruined my joke right at the end where I was going to ask whereabouts in your top 10 does anyone, Anywhere But You. Couldn't do it. So
yeah, no, fine. Didn't make it. Couldn't make it happen. So, but do check out Reality. I'm not even sure if it's turned up, and we probably should have done this prior to the thing to tell people where we can see these. But Reality, I know it's playing on some of the US streamers. Don't know if it's made its way to the Australian streaming platforms yet. But when it does, do check it out.
Yeah, Simon, I think you'll find that Reality is playing right now on Binge.
Beautiful. Good to know. Make sure you check it out.
Yeah, what's your number I will. Seven? My number seven is, and look, I think it's time that I really embrace the art house in a much more serious way here. So I'm going for Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1.
Our lives are the sum of our choices. And we cannot escape the past. Ethan, this mission of yours is gonna cost you dearly.
Look, real talk, this isn't the best of the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible films, but yeah, it's a damn fine movie. I had a blast with it. What else is there to say? There were big stunts. I will say this movie, I don't think for all the attention that gets laid upon what is always the big stunts of the movie, while this may have been a technically difficult stunt to pull off, I don't know that it really necessarily translated to all that impressive a moment on screen, which was Tom Cruise on a motorcycle, jumping off the edge of a cliff and then paragliding down onto a moving train. I'm sure that is not easy to do. I've only done it 2 to 3 times before in my life.
It's not that tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was the same, and I agree that this isn't the best of the Mission Impossible films. I don't think it had a really strong sort of central villain in it, which
well, the villain's an algorithm.
The villain is an algorithm, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it. But it did lend itself for some big stunts. It went a little bit heavy on the CGI for me. The stunts in a lot of the Mission Impossible films are very, I guess, realistic. And you're right, the riding a motorbike off a cliff in Norway is not the toughest thing in the world for a stunt person or even someone as well-versed in stunts as Tom Cruise is. But it's a...
I want to clarify. I don't want my statements to be misinterpreted here. I'm sure that it's actually really difficult to do in real life, but I don't know that difficulty translated to a particularly exciting on-screen moment.
Yeah, I agree with that. But barring one other action blockbuster that I'll mention a bit later in my top 10, I thought it was the best of the Hollywood action films this year. It certainly had a sturdiness to it that we've come to rely on from the Mission Impossible films.
And something that I really appreciated in this one was the introduction of Shea Whigham into the franchise. He, as soon as he appeared in it, it was something like, well, why hasn't he been part of the franchise already to this point? He, in this film, much like a lot of the movies he appears in, is kind of just like a well-worn boot. It just kind of feels like he's been there all along, and he just seamlessly fit right into the world of this. And I love seeing Shea Whigham any time that he appears in any movie or TV show. And this, like, it was just kind of, what's the one thing we could do to make Mission Impossible just feel better? And it's just including Shea Whigham. It's like in Parks and Recreation, where the first 2 seasons of that are really quite good, and then suddenly they managed to mix in Rob Lowe and Adam Scott. And it's like, oh, wait, no, now suddenly the show works. It's the same thing. Shea Whigham in there just suddenly made this sort of sparkle in a way that it just hadn't quite Whigham for some reason. That guy.
Right. All right. My number 7, this is a documentary that played a couple of the festivals here in Australia. I think it's going to make a much bigger splash in the new year when it gets a limited release. It's called Beyond Utopia.
So waking up one day and realizing that you were born on a completely different planet and everything you learned was a lie and the heroes you worship were actually monstrous villains. In North Korea, there is no freedom of religion, there's no freedom of thought, there's no freedom of press. The regime told us we are living in utopia, but we are captured in a huge virtual prison.
This is the story of Pastor Sun Yin Kim, who is a South Korean-based man who helps get refugees and families out of North Korea. And this is a story that is all shot in first person. It's all done with the factual film camera. They a filmmaker is embedded with a young family who are trying to escape the North Korean border, the North Korean regime. So it serves as a very human and at times heartbreaking story of this family going through a very tough time to get out of North Korea. And it takes advantage of that by also exposing some of the truths about the North Korean way of life and the heartless regime that sort of rules over the people and the society there. So this is the best first-person documentary film of the year. It reinforces the importance of film journalism and capturing these moments on film. And it's also a great, I guess you'd call it a geopolitical thriller in that it is very specific about the nations that are at odds here, set North and South Korea, and of the ideologies that are keeping them so distant, so separate, and have done for so many years now. So it's called Beyond Utopia. That is definitely one to see.
So when I think about my favorite movies generally, Simon, it is actually very rare that it's the Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1s of the world. Instead, the films that usually resonate with me are the very small lo-fi drama comedies, and the thing that's making my list here at number six falls very much into this bucket. It is Shortcoming.
I was practically the only non-white person in my entire high school.
And you never felt discriminated against?
I definitely did, but not because I was Asian.
Because of your inherent bad personality.
Exactly.
Do you remember that internship that I applied for?
What about it?
It's in New York.
New York is overrated. It's so gentrified now.
How many times have you even been there?
Are we counting layovers?
It's the writing, directing debut of comedian Randall Park, or comedy actor Randall Park, I guess, based on the Adrian Tamine graphic novel of the same name, which, again, also very big fan of that. Bit of prop work here for anyone watching the video of the podcast. Look, I really like this book and the film. I thought just a really strong translation of something which is kind of such a small, insignificant story that I would have thought it's fairly unfilmable. And I reckon there's probably quite a few viewers who walked away saying, what was that? Why did we waste our time with, you know, that for 91 minutes? But for me, this hit all the notes. And I reckon for anyone who is very serious about their movies and the sort of person that listens to a podcast like this, I reckon it probably resonates, you know, not insignificantly. The story is basically a young man who has very strong opinions about the movies that he consumes and just the general cultural inputs of those around him, including his girlfriend and her colleagues. Basically, he runs a small university movie theater, has all the opinions in the world about movies, but doesn't really know how to regulate his own life. So, you know, he certainly knows how movies should operate, but he doesn't know how to relate to another human being in a way that they're certainly happy with that interaction. Basically, he's a cantankerous, just awful human being, and I love him.
So few of us left. I know. This was one that I know it played the festival circuit here in Australia. I can't even be certain it went into cinemas. Did it get a bit of an art house run here in Australia, or was this seen on one of the streamers?
My knowledge, well, it's not even on a streaming service yet. This is hard to see. Okay. So it's only literally a 2023 film for me because it got played at the Sydney Film Festival, which you and I had something on that night, a recording. So I know that you missed out on seeing the film there because of this podcast.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And then it did play here as part of the Brisbane Film Festival. So it certainly got some play, but yeah, not much. And I managed to see it by having to rent it from an overseas service.
Sure. Okay. It's called Shortcomings. I'm going to check with Sony because maybe they're just sitting on it and going to release it further into 2024. Maybe it's one of those sort of.
You know what? It'll just crop up one day on Simon. It'll just crop up one day on Stan. That's how this sort of thing goes.
Yeah. That's a shame. All right. In 2023, Greta and Margot had a Dolly playdate and moviegoers to the tune of US $1.45 billion, the highest global gross in Warner Brothers history, turned out to see Barbie. It is my number six.
Hey, Barbie. Can I come to your house today?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned, just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
So cool.
Why this worked so well for me was, I think, almost a confluence of circumstance. After years of script development, and it went through a lot of different forms, this one. At one point, it was an Amy Schumer comedy. There were a whole lot of people attached to it early on. But the final polish came amidst the hashtag MeToo movement and Trump's toxic reign, and that infused this script written by Greta Gerwig and produced by Margot Robbie, and also Greta's husband, Noah Baumbach, got a script credit on this. I thought it was the funniest, smartest possible brand-based film adaptation maybe ever. And I think that it's all the acclaim that it's getting for its smarts as well as how great it looked on screen are thoroughly deserved. So Barbie's my number six.
Haven't seen it. Barbie's trash. Moving on. Not necessarily the movie, but the IP. Moving on, Simon, I'm going to drop in my number five, which if we want to talk about branded filmmaking, I'm going to talk about a little animated film called TMNT Mutant Mayhem.
We have a very important mission for tonight. We must use stealth and cunning to infiltrate the human world and retrieve Gogurt.
Okay, Batman.
Dude, what? I'm just trying to hype you guys up. Let's go!
Marking Ayo Edebiri's second ranking on the list of the definitive movies of 2023 is her voice work as April O'Neil in the Teenage Mutant Turtles animated film.
You love your turtles.
Look, the reason why this makes my list is because, one, I'm a lifelong Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fan, so already I'm sort of pre-bought into this, but it's not like I just give any Ninja Turtles movie a pass. I mean, those Michael Bay produced ones from a couple of years ago, I'm not even sure I ever saw the second one. The first one was, difficult to watch, I think is probably the polite way of talking about that one. They weren't good, but this was legitimately a really fun animated feature, and one of the issues I've had with American animation, particularly in the last 25 or so years, is that you've got cinema animation, which very much took on the same look and feel of Pixar circa 1995 with Toy Story.
Totally
and
agree.
There's very little experimentation. Very little experimentation taking place in terms of visual stylings. Really, up until we saw the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. A movie a couple of years ago. As soon as that came out, suddenly people were like, oh wait, you could actually do something else that's actually visually interesting with animation. What a crazy idea. It was just such a bugbear that we had to wait so long for a film to really come out and be a fresh of breath air in that space. You get the same thing on TV, where so many of the shows emulate the bento box production house style, where they all just kind of look and feel exactly the same. And it doesn't matter how good the writing is on most of these shows, it just feels of a piece. So this Ninja Turtles film came out, which took the same approach that Spider-Man movie took, which is, how about we do something that actually feels bespoke and of this world that we're creating, and make it not feel like anything else you've seen. Visually, this film just completely popped off the screen. But the other thing that it does is that it showed me, and I've seen so many incarnations of the Ninja Turtles over the years. So this is a franchise, a property I grew up with as a 10-year-old. When it first sort of debuted here in Australia. And I've seen a lot of incarnations over the years. I've read a lot of different variations of it through comic books. Like, I've seen the origin story of the Turtles a bunch of times, but this actually felt fresh and new. It was a new way of doing the Ninja Turtles. And it was in a movie that was also very good and very entertaining. And I don't know, like, me putting it on my list of the 10 definitive films of the year at number 5, maybe a little bit high, but at the same time, I also just want to credit the movie for doing something fresh with what is otherwise a tired, been there, seen that property.
Produced and written, and I think he probably voiced something. Seth Rogen is clearly a fan on the scale that you are, and he brought all that fanboy knowledge and fanboy spirit to the film. So yeah, I totally agree. It didn't make my top 10 or 20, but it's a film that I think also that animators in Hollywood who are working over properties that skew a little bit older maybe give themselves a bit more freedom or allowed a bit more freedom. Spider-Man skewed a little bit older and they was able to embrace this new animation style, and Turtles were the same thing. As we record this, the reviews are dropping for the new animated film Migration, and the general consensus is that it looks so generic. And although they've got the French filmmaker who did Ernest and Celestine a few years ago, he's literally just been hogtied by the studios to create another film that just looks like a Disney ripoff. So while we're a bit down on Migration, we're certainly up on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So, yeah, good choice. No dramas with that at all.
Yeah.
My number five.
I'm with you there at number five.
Number five for me is a little film from German director Wim Wenders. He went to Japan and made a movie called Perfect Days.
Simon, has Perfect Days received a release anywhere, or is this just a film festival screening?
This was just a film festival screening to date. I think it's queued up for first quarter of next year here in Australia. Koji Yakusho won the Cannes Best Actor Trophy for his role as Hirayama. He's sort of a Tokyo everyman who literally just sort of wakes up, goes through his routines, and then starts his work day cleaning toilets in the city of Tokyo. Don't worry, you don't see anything too gross in this film. But he finds so much joy in the smaller things of life, reading a book by lamplight or his favorite driving song or just a sandwich in the park, and most especially even the slightest moment of shared joy with a stranger. And clearly we come to learn that there's more to Hirayama's inner life, but director Wim Wenders, he'll take you there when he's good and ready. There's been a few complaints that this is kind of a slow film, kind of even a boring film, in that it just sort of recounts this man's life as he goes through it day to day. It could be anything other than that. It's such a rich film. Afterwards, I was absolutely floating out of the cinema with this movie. So it's called Perfect Days, and it should be in cinemas, I think, early in 2024.
Yeah, Perfect Days is expected to be the Japanese entry for the Academy Awards. And so there's been a lot of sort of attention placed on the fact that that has been the nomination, but not Godzilla Minus One, which is the film that is shockingly resonating really, really heavily in the US right now. Audiences have taken to this film in a really big way there. I know when I saw it here in Australia, it was a... I'm going to say like a Wednesday night screening. It was like 6 o'clock in the evening. So I thought, you know, there's not going to be anyone at the theater getting along to see this, but there was maybe about like 20 people in the theater. So this one's just quietly humming along. And I think audiences are not only just turning up for it, but also are really enthused by this latest Toho Godzilla film.
Is that your number four?
It is not. That's me just interested in the Japanese Academy Award nominations. But, Simon, look, here's the thing. I'm not really even that big an animation guy. And yet, somehow this year, three animated movies made my list. And obviously, I've talked about Suzume. I've talked about Mutant Mayhem. So, obviously, Spider-Man Across the Universe, Spider-Verse, was going to make the list somewhere. And it does. It's sitting here at my number four.
I can hear you being quiet, Mom.
I, hope I didn't ice your game, man.
No one my age says those words in that order.
It's just hard to see my little man not being my little boy all the time.
Yeah.
You know, for years I've been taking care of this little boy.
When I went and saw... what was that movie? It was Venom, when that played in the theater. And you were at the screening, as I recall, Simon.
We went to the 4DX screening,
Yeah, so Event in Sydney were trying to show off their latest innovation, being the 4D theater. This is the one where you go in there and you sit down. Yeah, you sit down, they spurt water in your face. They've got a chair on hydraulics that moves around and they throw steam at you and all sorts of stuff. Like, it's pretty fun. And with a trashy, terrible movie like Venom, like, it's the perfect way to see it. Now, I did go and see Christopher Nolan's Tenet through a 4DX theater. And in my opinion, that is exactly how Mr. Cinema wanted me to see the movie.
Okay.
Yeah. With my chair vibrating.
I've never been back. That's my one and only 4DX experience, seeing Venom with you. So I've never been back.
I've actually seen it a couple of times since, like a couple of different things since then. But anyway. When we were there, and they did this for all the screenings, it wasn't just the one we were at, but midway through the closing credits, instead of a mid-title sequence in the way that all the Marvel films usually drop something like that in, and I think Venom did have one or two of those sequences as well, they shamelessly just dropped in like about a minute and a half of the Into the Spider-Verse movie. And I remember watching it going, oh, that was kind of interesting, but, you know, whatever. I wasn't super excited by it. Then a film came out and it knocked my socks off. And it was absolutely one of my films of, what was it, like 3 or 4 years ago now. Loved the movie. Yet when this sequel came out, I was just nonplussed. I remember going along to a screening, feeling more obligation than anything else. And I was just caught up in the action, the emotional stakes of this movie, the... large multi-universe capers that were taking place. Like, it was a incredibly engaging movie where they not only just took the animation style of what was already a fairly revolutionary animated film from a few years beforehand and stepped it up. Like, it is 40% more imaginative, 43% more imaginative than the previous film. Like, it just ticked all the boxes. And I remember sitting there feeling really anxious as it started making its way to the closing minutes of this movie, where I looked at my watch thinking, this is the end of the movie. They can't resolve this. Is this part one? And then it ends on a cliffhanger, and my heart sank because I was so deeply invested in what was happening. I easily could have got another hour and a half with this movie. Like, it was such a fun cinema experience, and it absolutely makes my list. I don't know how it can't.
Yeah, well, you had that Jerry Seinfeld moment where you realize at some point that he does that stand-up bit about they're not going to wrap this up in the time I've got to watch this movie. This is going to be to be continued, isn't it? And I totally agree. And I should also point out that I think the no word in the English language rankles me or gets my shekels up other than multiverse, and how not to handle a multiverse storyline was revealed in The Flash this year, but how exactly to handle a multiverse storyline was shown in the Spider-Man film, which does it just so expertly, with complexity, but with a clarity that even a doofus like Old Man Foster could understand. I was so caught up in the way he was jumping from world to world and Spider-Man to Spider-Man that I thought it was, I totally agree. I think it's a terrific film.
Look, I think they handle the idea of the multiverse well in the Spideyverse films. Look, I'm a lifelong comics reader, and I've never cared for multiverse storytelling just generally in any of the comics I've read. And so many lean into it in a really big way. DC particularly really sort of coined the idea of multiple worlds. But I'd actually say that The Flash, I thought, handled it reasonably well. It's a lot of the Marvel films from the last sort of generation of Marvel films that I think have really sort of dropped the ball and be able to make this comprehensible to an audience.
All right, my number four, and the reason I was so interested in if your Godzilla rant was a chronological one, was in the part of the order that we were doing this, because my number four is Godzilla Minus One, the film that you touched on just a little while ago. It's, as you mentioned, it's been a while, I think 7 years since Toho Studios released a Godzilla adventure, and us sort of Godzilla buffs have had to do with the just okay, usually pretty crappy Hollywood versions of the stories. This year, Toho and an FX sort of master turned director, Takeshi Yamazaki, took Godzilla back to a post-World War II Japan. That's why it's called Minus One, because in the chronological order, it's actually the first film after the original Godzilla movie. And I thought it was just the most exciting action blockbuster of the year. The effects work and the monster work was terrific, but it was so engaging as a story about this young family as a microcosm trying to rebuild their lives, and also a nation of Japan trying to rebuild itself. Because the great thing is about setting it in a post-World War II Japan is that you have none of the laser missiles or nuclear weapons, or I guess you have the nuclear weapons, but you don't have any of the high-tech military might that the Americans used to fight Godzilla in their movies. In this one, it was about the people, the heart, the soul, the energy that they brought to fighting Godzilla. Plus, it's such an amazing looking film, and Godzilla is such an amazing creation. I was just blown away by Godzilla Minus One. It's coming back to the IMAX in Sydney in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to go and see it again there because it's a film that benefits from the biggest big screen experience.
And because Simon loves the IMAX, Simon and the IMAX sitting in the tree.
It's you and 4DX and me and IMAX. We've both got our preferred gimmicky formats.
I mean, IMAX isn't a gimmick, and how dare you suggest the same thing about 4DX? If I want to experience cinema in the truest way possible, it requires me on a hydraulic chair.
I know this now. I'll just sit behind you at screenings from now on in, and I'll be your 4DX. I'll just start shaking the chair and spitting in your face at the appropriate moments.
Good luck, because cinemas these days, the chairs are so far away from each other, you won't be able to reach. Your arms aren't that long. They're little Godzilla-sized arms. Trying to get to your chair.
All right, funny man. What's your number three?
Look, Godzilla Minus One, like, it's definitely in my top 20 for the year. I think that what disappointed me about it, and I mentioned this the other week when we talked about it, was I just thought some of the character work in the back third of the movie, like, just got a little bit sort of hacky in a way, which is a real sort of downstep from, I think, some of the really good work they were doing through most of that movie. But anyway, moving on to my number three is a movie which, frankly, should be number one on everyone's list, including my own. It's a movie called Bo is Afraid.
I'm visiting my mother tomorrow.
Hi, Carrot. It's Mom. I'm just calling to say that I'm so, so, so excited to see you tomorrow. You're my angel, and I love you. Okay. I love you. Okay, bye, sweetie. I love you.
Are you at the airport?
I'm on my way. It's not safe, is it? What do you think I should do?
I'm sure you'll do the right thing, sweetheart.
Simon, it is a bold cineast who puts Bo is Afraid in their top five, let alone their top three. But I'm going out there because this film, boy, wow. Simon, no movie has stuck with me more than this movie throughout the year. I remember going out of the movie thinking, if I never see that movie again, that's fine. I loved what I did just then, yeah. But at the same time, I never want to experience it. But I'm here like maybe 7 months later and I've got this pang. I need to go back and see Bo is Afraid.
No way. There is no way that I could sit through that film again. It was like a living nightmare. This is not to say I didn't like it. Didn't make my top 20, but it was certainly an experience to be had. It's for me, it's Ari Aster making that second or third film choice to make when he's got the keys to the city, and every filmmaker does it. One of my favorite movies is one of those films, not Spielberg's 1941, but he was said, hey, you've made these two incredible films with Hereditary and Midsommar. A24 came along and say, go and do whatever you want with all the money we can provide you. And he came back with Bo is Afraid, which I thought is a wildly flawed but totally nutty folly that I will grow to like, but I just couldn't do it again right now.
Give it a couple of years. Let's revisit this list and let's see how high on the list it is. I reckon number one. Okay, so if people don't know Bo is Afraid, this is a movie with Joaquin Phoenix as a man who, let's say he's got some issues. It opens with him at a therapist's office, and the key to this movie is that he's given some medication right at the very beginning of the movie, and then everything we see after that is very much through a, let's say, a very particular lens. They never expressly say that this is the result of the medication he's on, but to me, that's the only interpretation of this movie. What we see for the first third of the movie is him living in a hellscape New York that is kind of every bit the nightmare fuel that Fox News say that New York is without it actually really being the case. There's riots on the street. There's people chasing after him. There's the anarchy that ends up seeping in from the street into his apartment. There's the banging on the door that he can't really wrap his mind around. There's all the shenanigans happening in his apartment. And then suddenly he ends up leaving the apartment and finds himself out in the countryside for the second third of the movie, where it's about him needing to leave there. Then there's a little dalliance where there's a engagement with a traveling theater show, which is probably the least engaging part of the movie, I think. It doesn't really quite work. And I don't even know how to link this together as part of a narrative through line that makes any sense whatsoever.
Doing a hell of a job.
Because none of it does. Parker Posey turns up in probably the greatest scene that we'll see on cinema screens all year. Oh, and bear in mind, I still haven't seen Poor Things yet. And there's one scene in that I'm particularly excited about seeing, which may top it. I'm not too sure. But Parker Posey, incredible in this movie. Something happens to Parker Posey in this film I didn't think I'd ever really see on the cinema screen, and I'm glad that it happened. And then the very end of the movie is kind of a static shot, which I saw right through the end, waiting what was going to happen, and then it faded to black, and I walked out of the theater confused, not sure where I was in the world, not sure what was going to happen to me for the remaining years that I have. This film's magnificent.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's completely nuts. And I'm glad these films get made, but wow. I think it holds the record for both the biggest single screen opening of the year and then the biggest sort of drop off of the year. They literally couldn't sell this film outside of smarty pants on the East Coast and cool kids on the West Coast. Literally nobody else in America wanted to watch this film, which I thought was a fascinating way that to tell this story, because it is a bizarre movie. And like I say, all power to Ari Aster for getting it made and doing it his way. But yeah, maybe I will revisit it at some time when I'm on that medication that you mentioned.
I just like to give some very strong props props to my pal Eddie, who I mentioned this movie, and he went home that evening and watched the movie in the comfort of his own home without stopping the film. And I just think that is a triumph. If any action deserves some sort of Order of Australia medal, it's the ability to be able to watch that movie at home without pausing it, without stopping it, or without watching it in like 12 to 15 chunks over the course of a week.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Good luck to him. He sounds like quite the character. I'm coming back around for my third film. It is Past Lives. We mentioned it earlier. It was the year's most beautiful narrative, the story of a soulful connection that fate is trying to keep apart in this life anyway. Celine Siong's a major talent. It's sort of a deconstruction of love that kind of tears at the very fiber of what we've been conditioned to expect from a screen romance. And I disagree with you about Greta Lee. I think she's wonderful. I haven't seen her in Morning Show, so I can't sort of bring that comparison to it. But I think she's got a Best Actress nomination in the bag. So there we go. Past Lives is my number three film. Your number two.
Past Lives, in so many ways, exactly the same movie as Beau Is Afraid.
You're nuts. God, you're getting crazy.
Practically
you
the same movie. Okay, moving on. My number two, Simon, is a movie that I thought was just the absolute bee's knees. It is Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
Every year at Barton Academy, students, faculty, and staff depart the campus for a two-week winter break. But there are always an unfortunate few who have nowhere to go for the holidays. They're known as the Holdovers.
Mr. Hanum. Simon, I walk down the streets and people are like, The Holdovers, when's it coming out? When's it coming out? And I'm like, guys, I've seen The Holdovers. At that point, people drop to their knees and they're not bowing at me, but they're just standing at me in reverence that I have been one of the lucky people in Australia to see The Holdovers. Okay, so if people don't know this movie, this is Alexander Payne. He's the gentleman that made some of your favorite movies like Election. What else he made? The Descendants. About Schmidt. Sideways. Etc.
Downsizing.
We don't talk about Downsizing, Simon. Nobody talks about Downsizing.
It was what it was.
No, look, Downsizing, and look, we may have even already said this on the podcast. I don't really know. Downsizing, I thought, admirable failure. I could see what they were going for. They swung big, and sometimes when you swing big, it doesn't necessarily pay off. Sometimes you swing big and you get Beau Is Afraid, and then other times you get Downsizing. All right. So, Simon.
Okay, so Holdovers is the must-see film.
Like, it absolutely is. So the film absolutely lived up to the hope that I had for it, which was Alexander Payne back in form after Downsizing. You know, we all felt a little bit awkward about seeing the next Alexander Payne movie, but absolutely delivers here. I think it just works a treat. The premise of this one, and look, if the premise of this movie sounds appealing to you, this is going to be one of your favorite movies of the year. Okay, if it doesn't sound appealing, then, you know, just move on here. Go see Beau Is Afraid and we'll just catch up later. So the premise of it is that you've got Paul Giamatti. He's a very cantankerous teacher in the, early 70s. They say the year. I'm going to just say it's like 1974, thereabouts. Everything about this movie is filmed as though it's a film from 1974. So it just treats it as authentically as possible. Yeah, from the title cards through to like the various sort of badges of studios and whatnot.
Even the trailer. The trailer was cut together as a 70s trailer, which looked beautiful.
Yeah. It's fantastic. But Paul Giamatti, cantankerous teacher, he's in a private school and is a guy who I'm not going to give away too much, but he's found himself working in this private school that he also went to school in as a kid. So he hasn't really left this school for most of his life. He teaches there. He doesn't really have a romantic sort of love interest at all, and possibly never has. He's a quiet man of books. Is, I guess, maybe just the polite way of talking about his sad sack state of life. Through a series of just dick moves, he finds himself having to look after the remaining kids at the private school who don't have anywhere to go over the Christmas break. So while everyone's heading off to their respective homes, and because it's an affluent private school, there's a lot of snow trips and, you know, fairly big overseas holidays that all these kids are going off to. There's a motley crew of, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 boys that are left to hang out there at the house, the grounds of the thing, of the school. You've got that. He's dealing with them. But there's one kid in particular that just really grates on the Giamatti character. And through a twist of fate, most of the boys end up being sort of swept away and taken on a snow trip away from the place. But the one kid who couldn't get permission was the one that's like the real pain in Giamatti's sort of side. And it's the two of them kind of lacked into a battle of wits in a very sort of quiet, lo-fi kind of a manner in this household, in this hall, I guess. So it's those two. There's also a woman played by Joe Devine. Randolph? Joe Randolph Devine. That's her name.
Yep.
Yeah. She's there. She's a woman who is a kitchen hand, runs the kitchen. Her son is early 20s, but got killed recently in the Vietnam War, because obviously Vietnam War is still raging. So that's kind of the background as to what's going on in the US at the time. And that boy had also been at the school. And the only reason she was really there as a cook at the school was to make sure that her son was able to attend it and be given the opportunity to be able to go off. To go to school and go to university, but couldn't do that. Instead had to go to war and got killed there. So there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of hostility taking place in this household. But then they all come together over this Christmas period, and it's really sweet. And it is probably, if you ask me, the ultimate Christmas movie. Like, it really ticks all the boxes. And so the question I have is, if this is such a strong embodiment of a Christmas movie, why is it being released here in Australia in the middle of January?
Good point. Alexander Payne does white people problems very, very well. This feels like exactly the sort of setting that he should excel in, and by all accounts he has. I mentioned to you before the podcast that I still haven't seen this, and I'm one of the few critics here in Sydney who hasn't seen it yet, and every screening I go to, it happened the other day with Poor Things, that people are saying, oh, you've got to see Holdovers, it's amazing, you'll love Holdovers. So it's becoming certainly the critics darling here in Australia that you suggest it ought to be. So yeah, definitely keen to check it out, and I'll be reviewing it in the weeks ahead on Screen Watching.
I'll say this, when I told friends that I'd seen The Holdovers, pretty much all of my friends who are very white and have a university education were all very excited about seeing the movie.
That's about right. Yes, exactly right. All right, we're getting into my number 2 film. Now, I've done something different here. This year, there was a resurgence of a particular type of film that I couldn't put any one of these films into the number
wait,
one
wait.
Slot.
Wait, have you seen the new take on Emmanuel? Is that where this is headed?
I've been watching those sort of movies for years. No, they've stayed the same pretty much since the beginning of time. No, this is my number 2 title this year is, quote unquote, the concert film. Now, you know how much I love Taylor Swift, the Eras Tour, and audiences around the world have loved it as well. Then Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, came along, also an incredible cinematic experience. Can the concert documentary recapture that immersive thrill of the world's biggest music shows? No, it can't. Of course it can't. But the very best do what any great cinema does, and it conjures a version of reality that enhances it, as only film can. Whether it's Taylor's sort of the high she puts you on with her performances, or the glimpse inside the brilliant diva's mind that the Beyoncé film does. There's no matching the sheer cinematic bravado, I guess you could say, that they provided in 2023 or in 1984, for that matter, as the remastered Stop Making Sense reaffirmed. Those three were three of my greatest and most cherished movie-going experiences of the year. So the number two film for me this year is The Concert Film.
So, Simon, number one on my list, because the movie is so good, it deserves to be in two places on my list. It's Beau Is Afraid. No, it's
Beau Is Afraid.
That's just silly. Okay, my number one on the list, and look, because this is a definitive list, like it's definitive, like there's no arguing it, but also just quietly, it's just that it's hard to divorce yourself from films that are just kind of catered exactly towards your interests. And this film just came along and just ticked so many boxes and was just immediately a Dan Barrett movie that there was no way that I couldn't put this as number one. Simon's trying to work out what it is. And when I say what it is, you're like, oh, that's right. You were rapturous about that just a few weeks ago. It's a movie called Leave the World Behind, a Netflix original movie made to be watched at home, but I saw it on the big screen. This is Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, what's his name from all the movies that I love? Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke, Kevin Bacon, they're all in there. Oh, I gave something away then.
Ah, spoiler. His name is in the opening title, so it's not that big a reveal. Yeah. And he's like in the film right at the beginning, but then he comes in a really big way at the end. Sorry, spoilers. Yep. People have had time to see this movie. I think lots of people have already watched it. It's actually done very well for Netflix, which surprised me.
It has done very well for them.
Yeah, the response has been mixed, which I kind of expected. It's a film that doesn't give away a lot of answers and is very sort of minimalist in its... It's a hard film to call minimalist because every single moment where nothing's happening, everything is happening all at the same time. Like, it is a...
Good point, well said.
Visual and loud feast for the senses with some very sort of sparse and basic settings taking place, as magnificent as that house is.
Get a bat.
I'm so sorry to bother you, and this is our house.
This is your house?
Driving back to the city, then something happened.
You want to stay here, but we're staying here.
We need to get them out of here.
This is an end of the world drama, which is it the end of the world or is just the end of a sense of privileged America? Who can really say, what are all those deer doing? Sure, none of that makes any sense in the context of the actual movie.
That's true.
When you really think it through, it's like there's actually no way you can explain any of that business. But there is just something so magnificent about, and it's a film that I don't really want to talk about because people just kind of need to experience it. It is a family who gather at a country home. It's like an Airbnb. And as they're getting there, society is crumbling around them. And they don't really understand that because they're on holidays and they're kind of removed away from their day-to-day processes and contact with the world. So when you have that little bit of remove, it's actually quite easy for some of the big things to get past you. And that's kind of what's taking place here. It's an America that has been shut down with very little news and information going around. And because they are removed from their usual sources of connectivity with their community, like they just don't have any way to really comprehend the scale as to what's happening around them. That's enough.
Yeah, I remember you saying at the time,
good performances.
I remember you saying at the time that this was going to be your, you know, very near the top of your best of the year. I remember the text you sent me, and having seen the film, I don't disagree. Yeah, it's a terrific piece of filmmaking, and all the stars do some of their best work. So, yeah, no dramas there.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the text message I sent you. You're going to hear from my lawyers.
This will make for good podcasting. Settle in, everyone, while Dan looks at his phone messages.
Yeah, it's like the holdovers again.
Yeah, it goes way back. Yeah, no, you said something. Oh, it might have been an email, but anyway,
I can't believe
you were very excited about seeing it. You were completely taken by surprise when you heard it was at cinemas. You were saying, "What? It's where? It's doing what now?" It did play. Just like Maestro did, and I think like Society of the Snow, Netflix are creeping a few of their bigger titles for a few cinema sessions.
But look, that happens. That happens at the end of every year.
Yeah, yeah, they've done that. All right, yeah. You're so ready? Look, I'm going in for my number
end of every
one.
Year. Sorry, Simon, we've got some lag at the moment, so hopefully the audience haven't quite figured out what's going on here. But at the end of every year, as Netflix have their big award film pushes, they are obligated to play into a certain number of theaters throughout the US in order to qualify for the Academy Awards. But at the same time, they do tend to do a bit more of a rollout across the US and then in some international territories as well. The films never get booked into the big VMAX theaters in any of the like events or like the Hoyts Sen Stadium. Is that the branding? I don't think that's right. I think it's called something else there. Nor do they get played in the, they also don't get played in the D box or the 4DX theaters, which I think is a real shame for something like Maestro. But largely, they are cinema releases and you can kind of enjoy that, or you can see the movies that are meant to be seen, which is in your lounge room.
Stop saying that. That's not, you know, that riles me when you say that. Hello, we're meant to be seen on the little screen. Yeah. All right. Okay. I'm working up to my
Simon,
number one now. I should
there's,
point out
there's
no,
one
I'm
thing,
my number one.
There's one thing that my grandmother always used to say. If a movie starts like this, dun dun, it's meant to be watched on Netflix. And yes, Netflix, both of my grandmothers have been dead for over 20 years, but that is neither here nor there.
They saw it coming. All right, my number one spot. I should point out that in my number one spot, you're not going to see Poor Things, which is getting a lot of chitter-chatter at the moment. Oppenheimer made my top 20, but not my top 10. I loved still a Michael J. Fox movie, but I didn't put that in there. Asteroid City I loved, but I didn't put in there. The film that I'm putting into number one, I saw at a festival, and it's getting some of the best reviews of the year around the traps. It's actually being released in the first or maybe second week of January here in Australia. It's called Anatomy of a Fall.
So as you know, the autopsy report is inconclusive about the cause of death.
Stop. I did not kill him.
That's not the point.
So the framework for this film is pretty stock standard. It's a cop procedural courtroom drama. Did he fall? Was he pushed? What does the boy know? And an Anatomy of a Fall, you can tell by the title that's what it's about, is a compelling take on that fairly well-worn genre. It does those sort of that side of the story very well. But the director, Justin Trietz, it's her best ever film, and it's got a whole lot more to say than that. A marriage is imploding. A young boy, a child, is witness to this disintegration of his stability. Violence sort of dwells and swells within this middle-class setting. To me, Anatomy of a Fall is anxiety as an art form. It's a really intimate epic about how deceitful we're willing to be to not only keep secrets, but to convince ourselves we are justified in doing so. It is such a compelling film. I had no idea it ran 171 minutes because at the time it flew by and I was completely gripped by it. 2 points I want to make. I complain a lot about films being too long, but 9 of my top 20 films run over 2 hours. And I am also kind of happy to say that quite by chance, I didn't even know this going in, but 7 of my top 10 films, if you, I guess, say top 12, if you break down the concert films I had in there, are directed by women, which I was happily surprised by, I should say. I was surprised that they got in there because there's some great stuff in there. But Anatomy of a Fall, I think, is a terrific film. And the actress who leads it, Sandra Hüller, she's the finest European actress of her generation. She was in Tony Erdmann a couple of years ago. And she's also coming out in a film that I did see this year, but I'm going to sort of slot it into my next year's top 10 list. It's called The Zone of Interest, about the family that lives next door to the concentration camp. And she's chilling in that as well. She's the finest European actress of her generation. Anatomy of a Fall is in cinemas on January 17.
Okay, Simon, just briefly as we wrap this up, let's just, first of all, just run through our lists again. My 10 through 1, I had Air, Past Lives. I'll one day get this title of that movie right. Suzume, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1. Fascinatingly, there's never going to be a Part 2, but that's a little side thing. You're across that, Simon?
No, I'm not across that. What's the buzz there?
Well, the film didn't do very well at the box office. And the reason it didn't do well at the box office, I mean, there's a few reasons. But one of the reasons was that it came out the week before Barbenheimer. And because of the relationship that Christopher Nolan has with the IMAX people, all the premium format screens were more or less signed over to Oppenheimer. And as a result, the Tom Cruise film just got squeezed out of all the premium format screens. So they couldn't charge anywhere near as much money per ticket. And then on top of that as well is, why would you go to the cinema to see a big spectacle movie when you're not able to see it on a big screen with big sound? Like, you don't want to go down to like cinema, like 12 to go and see like your big Tom Cruise action film. You're just going to stay at home or watch that on TV in a few months' time.
It was the number one. It was the film that took the brunt of the Oppenheimer wave. Yeah, you're right. It came out just before the week or so before that. And
it
was the one that got swept up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so as a result of that, they're going to reformat the part two movie to be more of a standalone movie. So you've got part one, cool, and then it'll be like the Leonard part six of cinema. There's just never going to be an additional one.
Look it up, kids. So what'd you get up to? So you got number seven on there.
Number 10, Air. Number 9, Past Lives. Number 8, Suzume. Number 7, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, part one. Number 6, Shortcomings. Number 5, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. Number 4, Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse. Number 3, the film of the decade, Beau is Afraid. Number 2, The Holdovers. And then number 1, the film made for Netflix, Leave the World Behind.
For me, counting down, Bottoms was number 10, the animated film Nimona on Netflix at number 9, Reality at number 8 with the great Sydney Sweeney, the documentary Beyond Utopia at 7, number 6 is Barbie, number 5 is Perfect Days, number 4, Godzilla Minus One, see it on a big screen, number 3 is where I put Past Lives or First Lives, whatever you want to call it, number 2, the concert film led by Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour. And number 1 is Anatomy of a Fall, which I saw at the Sydney Film Festival in Australian cinemas from January 17.
Yeah. The other thing I just wanted to throw out was, like, quite often we'll do your honourable mentions, and I just wanted to throw a couple of titles out there of things that is a honourable mention. But at the same time, Simon, also there's just movies that I want to be able to have seen that I wasn't able to include on this one. So I'm going to start with those titles that I suspect would have made my list if I'd had the chance to see them by now. Society of the Snow, which I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. Poor Things is probably the other big one. And then also you mentioned it just a moment ago, which was, and I've just forgotten the name of the film, The Zone of Interest.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, that played at the Jewish Film Festival here in Sydney, which Fiona and I got to see, but it's a... Boy, it's a grueling, beautifully artful film, but just quite shocking in its depiction of the banality of evil.
Yeah. And if people don't know that film, it's from the director of, what's that Scarlett Johansson movie where she's the alien? And
Sexy Beast originally, but also Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer. And he takes a lot of time between making films, and I can see why he had to get this one right, and he certainly did.
Yeah. So we've got that. And then the other film I just wanted to mention briefly was a film which technically came out, but, you know, it didn't really get a proper release anywhere. It was just something that I stumbled across on Stan, something I'd been waiting for, you know, a year or two. And then I'm like, oh, wait, it's actually available. And it was technically a year after it had been released. And I don't know when a Stan drop happened. So it could have been maybe like that week. It could have been, you know, 6 months prior. Who really knows? But it's a movie called Paris 13th District. And Paris 13th District, I did talk about on the podcast, when I managed to come across it. Again, I mentioned my love of the graphic novels of Adrian Tamin. He's a American cartoonist, but a French filmmaker decided to adapt some of his short stories and convert them all into a very French black and white feature film.
Oh, very
and
French.
I think that film... Yeah, that film is very much in my wheelhouse of small lo-fi human stories. You know, just ticked a lot of boxes for me. Anyway, I really enjoyed that one. If you get a chance to find that one on streaming, give that one a look.
Yeah, I've mentioned a few of the films that I had in my next best 10. Oppenheimer, Mission Impossible was in my top 20, but not the top 10. A little Australian film I want to mention very quickly is called Time Addicts. Umbrella Entertainment put it into a few cinemas just at the end of November there, ahead of a home video release. It should be available to watch now. It is one of the cleverest, funniest, not without a dark edge, time travel stories, all done on a very small scale on the streets of Melbourne, but all done with a lot of humour, a lot of heart. And it's the first film in a long time, a first time travel film in a long time where I've been able to say, because I hate time travel films because they generally don't make any sense and you can kind of pick them apart. This one handled that side of the time travel story really, really well. So check out Time Addicts, and also check out the Shailene Woodley, Ben Mendelsohn film To Catch a Killer, which Roadshow absolutely dumped into cinemas without any fanfare, but it was just outside my top 10. It's a terrific serial killer chase film, and Woodley's great in that alongside our own Mendo. So plenty of good movies to watch this year. I managed to narrow down 475, and you managed to whittle down your, 75 films that you saw. So I think that's a good cross-reference for those out there of what to watch going forward. I'm keen to see what you think of Poor Things too. It's a weird film.
Yeah, look, I'm looking forward to a bit of weirdness in my life. I found it very interesting that neither of our top 10s included the most recent Martin Scorsese movie.
Or Napoleon, yep. Killers of the Flower Moon, or Napoleon didn't make our top 20.
Well, that leads into my next question, which was, what was your favorite Joaquin Phoenix movie of the year?
Oh, boy, this is a loaded question. I liked Bo is Afraid a lot better than I liked Napoleon, that's for sure.
So you would say that is your favorite Joaquin Phoenix movie of the year?
Oh, why were you a lawyer? Did you ever train to be a lawyer? Because sometimes you can twist the conversation in a... I love it. Yes, I like Beau is Afraid a lot more than I like Napoleon. Were they the only two? Did he voice something? Didn't he voice something along the way? I can't remember. Was there another Joaquin Phoenix film in there? We don't do worst films of the year, do we? We're not going to go down that path.
I mean, I try not to. Is there anything that you would like to put out there as your worst film of the year?
The two films that really irked me more than anything was Magic Mike's Last Dance. It was just the most tinny, horrible, convoluted, worthless sequel I saw all year. And that was this includes the year where Meg 2: The Trench was released, which was also terrible. And I mentioned this on the podcast just the other day, the preponderance of star heavy but otherwise worthless streaming star vehicles. And yes, cinema's been full of them for 100 years, but they're turning up. People like Gal Gadot in Heart of Stone or Chris Hemsworth in Extraction 2. The worst of the bunch was Ashton Kutcher and Reese Witherspoon in Your Place or Mine, which was the most horrible piece of romantic comedy bullshit I'd seen all year and just should not have been made at all. So I would say Your Place or Mine and Magic Mike's Last Dance were my two duds of the year.
Yeah, I'm not going to do all worst movies of the year because I think that's disrespectful to the medium that I love so much.
But aren't the really bad films being disrespectful to the audience that they should be talking to? That would be my argument. But yes, you're right. I watch so many, so I'm going to stumble across some real horrible films along the way, which I did with those two. So that's kind of one of the dangers of the business.
I mean, I think it's worth noting that no one sets out to make a bad movie. Sometimes it just happens.
Yeah, I agree. Although some actively don't worry if it's a good or a bad one. They just want to get it made.
also true.
There's other motivations. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that brings to the end our 2023 best of lists. Shoot us an email on screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com if you want to add any to the mix, and we can have a chat about those later. Good list, Dan Barrett. Did you mention Beau is Afraid? I remember that you had a bit of a crush on that film through the year.
I knew I forgot to mention something during the podcast. Maybe 2024. Anyway, folks, this has been Screen Watching, our definitive list of movies of 2023. We'll be back. I'm not even sure when to tell people that they'll be back. I haven't released a schedule as to where we're dropping
this. We will be back. No, exactly. Confirm. We will be back no matter what point. Yeah, we will be back.
Yeah. Okay. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. If you want more of me, check out alwaysbewatching.com. It's a newsletter. It has the latest in TV, streaming, and film. I'm sure I've published something interesting there recently. Simon, you're there over at the Screen Space.
Screen-space.net, which is where you can find all my writings, where you can find an expanded version of this list as well. I'll be putting something up there with a few more words of my own. And all the Screen Watching socials are open for business as well, at Screen Watching, at Screen _ Watching. I can't remember what they all are, and I haven't got them in front of me. So just do that thing you do on social media where you search for things and we'll be there. So happy Christmas or happy New Year or happy Easter, depending on when this goes out. So have a great time. Bye.
It'll be after Christmas, but before the next Hanukkah. Folks, we'll see you soon.